Does not mean I'm not kicking off answering a question, I'm kicking off the evening. I'm like the MC now.
That's great.
So there are quite a lot of questions, and I have to really admit I feel a little bit reluctant in the moment. My brain is very, very tired. And what we were thinking is that we might take questions in turn. There are about half of the questions are in Finnish, and Jukka very kindly will answer them all.
I'm still
Jukka. What did I just say?
I said Jukka again.
Oh God! It's my brain.
I think we've known each other for like 15 years. Right?
18 years. I think we know each other since about 16 years ago.
This will go out on Dharma Seed.
No, it won't. No, it won't.
Yeah. Well, it's the recording.
So this young man next to me, whatever his name is. So, enough. Serious. So how do we do it? We just pull a question whenever? Great, super tool. And then we might add to it or...
Just mix them all up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just take one. This is now what you see in me. It's a little bit aversion operating. Just watch it well, you know. Just do it.
Hence, currens in paron kiskela meditatio. So,
so usually at home, in the middle of a busy day, the moment of meditation is brings peace and brings down the heart rate. But here on retreat, it feels like it goes the other way around. Sitting down in the middle of peace, my heart begins to beat faster. Why is this, and can I stop it? Why didn't you take this one, Sumitra?
I think my first honest answer will be I don't know. I would know until I meet you personally and sit down with you, and we can maybe both sense into what it is that is happening. My sort of hunch from listening to the question, it's very, very common that in daily life we remain on a level where we have a lot, you know, those who like the sort of technical jargon, you know, we remain a lot in sympathetic activation. We are basically so used to running on a level of intensity in the central nervous system that is always, traditionally today, is what we call stressed. So of course, our ability with these practices, that's the beauty and the centrality of these tools, is they can begin to work into our whole system. And in the start, there is really that sense of relief and down-regulating. Hopefully, in time, it begin to work even deeper into our system. So you could begin to notice how our whole central nervous system becomes much more regulated and stable. However, when we come on retreat, if you notice, there is a sense of we begin to move into deeper conditioned levels. And what on the surface appears that there is a sense of calm, when we actually move into it, we notice that underneath there is a lot of activation. So again, if we speak in modern language, as most of you are familiar with the level of, for example, the work around trauma has very good languaging around this. It is as if when we basically drive, we drive with one foot on the accelerator, and then we also pull the brake. So and that's our normal condition. It's like we constantly live like this, and this is what is called the normal. It makes us feel we are somebody. And then when you come on retreat, and there is a sense of where we can for the first time gently try to release a little bit that one. You know, it's like that sense of gently try to let go of your mobile phone. You know. Then actually what you notice underneath is there is a whole level of activation. That's the most common symptoms that you, I guess many of you will notice in periods on retreat. often you can notice it also how when those periods where your whole central nervous system gets much more sensitized, you notice how it is, you know. You can sit here and then, for example, as soon as you go in the group interview, you know, lo and behold, you know, you feel like you're back in school exam. You know, you think, bloody hell, I don't even have to say anything, you know. So I hope that makes sense as an answer.
Skillful ways of dealing with emotions. One, I think it's maybe several pieces of paper. Suvacho mentioned in our group meeting that monks can be emotionally illiterate as they always only let their emotions dissolve. But is that not an important part of what we are practicing as well? Is it more skillful to be with the emotion first before letting go of it? Then it continues on a second part. And is it fruitful to turn back to the situation later on trying to find out what in us triggered us to react in such a way?
Oh, you don't
want to
try? Or?
All right, I'll. So, emotionally illiterate monks. Yeah, so we could say about the dissolution of emotions and meeting them and being with them. We could say that working with emotions in meditation practice, that there's different dimensions to the practice. So we could say one orientation of the practice in the context of, say, this retreat or in the context of emptiness practice is trying to understand from various perspectives what it means that an emotion is empty. And part of that is exploring this dynamic that I was talking about yesterday of how our habitual responses of aversion and grasping keep the emotion active. Keep it going or keep it in existence, and exploring this dependency of how we can, in fact, begin to, for example, relax or release some of this grasping and see how that begins to dissolve the emotion. And through that would be one perspective, one way of practicing that reveals to us the emptiness of the emotion, that it's conditioned by my way of looking, by the way that I'm responding to it. So that would be one avenue, and there would be different avenues. You know, one would be noticing, clinging to a sense of self, noticing how a self view actually props up certain types of emotions. Certain kinds of emotional constellations arise with certain kinds of self view, perspective, or a belief in an inherently existing self, and then we can practice with exploring the emptiness of self and what does that do, what kind of emotions rise or don't rise as we contemplate the emptiness of self. So those would be possible perspectives into the emptiness of emotions and watching the dissolution, and that can be a hugely important rich practice, and that can really bring a lot of freedom, because habitually, ordinarily, we give what's called inherent existence to our mind states and emotions. We believe them to be inherently existent. They feel very real to us as they occur. So important to kind of meditatively probe their unreality and their dependency. And then at the same time, as I wasn't in the group meeting that the notes referring to, but Suvacho was apparently giving a critique of what happens if you only do this, if you only do this kind of practice, only ever let emotions dissolve. So we can think that any practice has its shadow sides, or any approach to practice, if we only do one style of practice, it's going to be limited. It's going to give a limited fruit. So we might get very good at allowing the emotion to dissolve, but then we're missing out on other kinds of emotional work, which is also possible to work on meditatively. So we can say, you know, one example would be this very simple feeling into the texture of the emotion and kind of naming it or discerning between different types of emotion. Noticing how they resonate in the body, and kind of feeling into those resonances, and there's a richness and a beauty that comes from that, from that style of work, and an ability to kind of recognize, and then through that also actually express to other people what we're feeling, so that we can share. We're able to communicate with others, and that's so necessary for any deeper relationship, that we can express what we're feeling and recognize it within ourselves and share it with other people, and also to accommodate feelings and accommodate emotions in ourselves. So I guess that would be a kind of an overview into this question, that as the person asking, that there's this breadth of practice, that there's a variety of approaches in practice. So if we're engaging in emptiness practices, that we're not doing so exclusively, that we're interested in the whole breadth of also meeting our experience, meeting our emotional life, as well as kind of probing into its emptiness. So that. Yes.
Really hope I think you're sitting on it. Really try to formulate something, because I have to confess I am tired. So absolutely want to echo what you have said, and I think from my own practice, what can very easily happen, there is this beauty of actually, so to say, transcending the emotional life. Transcending it. And I think what a lot of us had to learn, you know, after they had to could let go of the content of experience, also to really deeply probe into content of experience. Because part of it's also, this is where the relational field is in. Yeah. When we are in relation with each other, when we are in relation in each other, in our, you know, family, in our, you know, in our day-to-day life, we are entering relational fields, and we have to deal with content. With content, to say then it's all empty, it's not the wise, it's not the best, it's not the most compassionate way. So I think we really have to hold both. And there can be a real, real beauty, a real, real juicy beauty to actually, to really figure out, you know, how does this work? You know, where do I get triggered? Why do I get triggered? Where do I get stuck? You know, what do I, what dynamics do I enter in? You know, we all of us, we have this painful dynamics where we very easily enter with each other. You know, and this is something we have to look at in terms of content. Yeah. So just to really add a little bit, you know, at ways, at times, really, really helpful to have, a more like a empty looking at emotion. Sometimes this is actually not the most helpful approach. It just isn't. We are using the wrong tool. Yeah. Does it make sense? So we always have to hold a whole range. Yeah.
I was thinking of a metaphrase to myself that would run along the lines of, may it be so that with my being and my actions, I embody freedom in relationship to myself and others. The word freedom now feels at the moment to be very central to myself. It's not a word that's present in the Nirodha dictionary that we have by the notice board. Is there a Pali version for freedom? Or is there a Pali word? Is freedom always something, or is always the cessation of something old and more space for something new? Is freedom, in capital letters, a big word of that means the small fleeting moments of presence, of mindfulness, of the moments where we have space to choose?
Don't know if I exactly understood all the layers of the question. And again, it's probably one first response is something, you know, with questions like this, it's really, really helpful to hear where a person is coming from and what exactly they are meaning. So I might be completely missing it. So I just start something off. One could say, yes, there is a word of freedom in Pali, and this is Nibbana, you know, unbinding. Yeah, unbinding. And I won't go now into defining this in any way or in its multiple ways. But I think what is really interesting, what I hear when someone writes something like freedom, this word, you know, without having to necessarily, this is what it's written in the sutta, and this is what this tradition thinks about it, and this tradition thinks that about it, and this is where they quarrel, is really to honor this resonance, to really honor this resonance. There is a meaning for you in this. You know, this is something that is important. You know, and one of the inquiries might even be, what do I actually mean by it? And I think, again, I'm just really associate here a little bit freely, like with the word of freedom, you know, I would imagine it's not a word where you will come, this is what I mean and this is what is meant, but it's an ongoing exploration, you know, where we will discover, you know, layers and layers and layers and layers and layers and layers. And yes, sometimes, you know, one can define, what was this, like the fleeting moments? Just, sorry, I can't.
Does it refer to the small fleeting moments of presence? The moments where we have the space to choose.
We can define this as moments where there is some freedom present, absolutely. I wouldn't personally be satisfied to stop here. this is not when I read the teachings, when I listen to the teachings, you know, what there is implied, it's something much more radical, yeah. But yes, there are moments of freedoms, each moment where there is a little bit sense of non-identification, where we actually can choose what we pick up and what we follow through or what we don't pick up. These are moments of freedom, absolutely. You know, as I said this morning, you know, with these different ways we can see, look at the spectrum of self, you know, to have more and more the freedom to actually travel on this spectrum, to hold different perspectives without having to fix ourselves. These are all expressions of more freedom out of an habitual unconscious mode. And it's not that I want to avoid the answer, but I do. And there is something for me beckoning, which is much, much radical, actually. And again, you know, just sometimes to really follow this resonance, this quivering of the heart. I have no idea, you know, but I want to explore. I want to explore. Anyone want?
On a group retreat, it sometimes feels as if sitting meditation is more important and then walking meditation is valuable but secondary. I'm contemplating an upcoming private retreat. I would like to hear your thoughts on how to choose the ratio of still meditating to moving meditation. Is there an advantage to choosing more of one over the other? Thank you. And there is also a heart. Again, it's one of these questions, you know, in some ways can you see it maybe appears simple, but so like how it speaks to me. It is like layers and layers also. So I'll try to say what I resonate with in it. First of all, if you've noticed some of the cultural blind spots we carry, we have a very deep inheritance that comes from our, sometimes some people will say is our Christian heritage, Judeo-Christian heritage, you know, it tends to make monotheists. There is one truth, and then, so it's like, it's a mindset that absolutizes and tends to make rights and wrongs, and then, you know, good and bads. And many of us feel the bads, you know, unless we get the goods kind of things. So if you notice, that's, for example, we think, oh, that's only stuff that happened once. And you notice, for example, how pervasive it is in contemporary culture, where we tend to, for example, this idea I sometimes jokingly, like others call, we are under a new religion called the religion of scientific materialism. You know, there is one truth, which is materialism or reality, and then there is the rest of it, which is just unproven superstition. But if you kind of notice in those differences, it's the same kind of mindsets that operate. Okay, so if we just hold this as in the background, yeah, when Buddha Dharma comes to the West, it's such a young plant, and that has incredible potential. You know, it comes from an old soil in Asia that sometimes it's also a little bit stuck in its own views. And coming over here very, very young, you know, I think less than 100 years, the first scholars came, and even the first translations, it's only now, the last few years, they try to revise them. Like this question that came up before, you know, for example, the word enlightenment. Well, of course, it's because the translations, the first Victorian translations, they gave awakening, you know, can you see it? They gave nirvana a certain slant that fitted a certain mindset, philosophical, you know. This is the rational, enlightened, liberating teaching, not all that superstition. This, you know, it was very sort of biased translation, subtly so. And you also notice they are very biased, subtly puritanical. You know, they give somehow a slant to the teachings that almost make the teachings appear, you know, as worldly, sensuous body things are a little bit, ooh, we should transcend them, you know. So it's like, it's not that it can get a bit sophisticated, but there is things in it like this. Turns out a long question, yeah, to a simple.
It was a long answer.
Sorry, turns out a long answer. I haven't even got to the point. So the point is.
wanted to say this thing about the Western materialism.
Yeah. No, actually, what I wanted to say, so if you've noticed how, for example, how you, if you begin to understand how ingrained it is in your psyche, this idea of, can you see, sitting is not just sitting, it's sitting. Can you notice how it's become this thing? Can you see this tendency, almost like, It's almost elevated, this thing we do on retreat that is so special. And then you have the Finnish variation, so serious. And you know, but if you notice, if you really understand how deeply we operate out of some assumptions that are binding, they are not liberating. And then, of course, if sitting is the real thing, and you notice you have a whole subculture then, if sitting is the real thing, then of course, I need the real posture. Well, then I need to do more yoga, and I know to do this, and have the right clothes and the right cushions, and you know, and all this. It becomes a whole way of life, sitting, and you know, and how, and we look at other people. If you notice, you know, how good are they sitting, and how good am I sitting compared to their sitting? can you notice they are so ingrained, some of these constructions we have, yeah, and if you notice, when you begin like that, then walking, well, that's that thing you do between sitting. You know? Can you notice? It's something, it's just because you can't sit. If you were really good, you would be able, of course, to sit in full lotus for a whole week and only eat one peanut. But since you are not there yet, you will do a little bit of walking in between. You know, once you get better, you will do less walking and more sitting. Can you follow? It sounds silly when you put it like, but if you realize how deeply ingrained and conditioned those constructions are all the time, yeah, and how we begin to build a kind of, the word in Buddhism is a kind of spiritual materialism. And, you know, so many of us have been through that or know that, you know. It's almost as if you sit with an inner timetable and clock off how many good hours of sitting you're doing, so you're not bad, you know. And when you, oh, I'm sitting less, oh, I'm getting bad, I'm losing my practice, you know. Can you see? It's like, it becomes like a sport almost. So I'm not, if you've noticed when I say this, I'm in no way devaluing the incredible power and value of sitting meditation. It's an amazing old technology. But can you notice how all these subtle forms of grasping comes in? So for example, in the transmission of Buddhism that comes from different cultures, they have different approaches to, it's like different approaches according to climate and history to how do you develop this quality of presence, calm, and inquiry? So for example, If you come from if you come from a Northern Asian tradition, China, Korea, and Japan, they tend to have a slightly different approach, where they don't do much walking, because of the climate. And in Southeast Asia, they tend to do a lot of walking. In the forest tradition, that for example, a lot of the insight tradition comes from Southeast Asian practices, you will do at least as much walking as sitting, if not more. It's known often that you do much more walking than sitting. It's like you can have a whole day where you walk, and then you will sit in the evening and night. Partly is due to the climate, you know, it can be very hot in the tropics. But the tradition of walking is, you know, it's really like they set up, many of you will know that, you know, these walking paths. They're really well done. So it's like here in the middle. And they're really formal. So you have like boundaries on both sides with beginning. So you really can like be completely relaxed and present with each step and stop at the end. And often at the end, they will have the sitting platforms. So you can go straight into sitting and you move back and forth in that way. So they consider with a lot of value in walking meditation. So it's like, what will be the right answer? Is there a right answer to a question? You know, it will be, trust yourself. Trust what feels right. Begin to experiment. What is it like? Do you operate out of any of these assumptions where you make these kind of constructs, you know? I should sit more or walk more and these kind of ways. And instead see when what works for you in your practice.
So, is it rolling? Yes, it's rolling. It's quite a long sentence, so I'm going to try and what do the Buddhist teachings say about the idea that our experiences and also our suffering, in addition to being conditioned by our minds, are also conditioned by our communities and societies and the power relationships and other conditions. Yeah, are conditioned also by these social forces. Did that make sense? Did people get that question? Yes, probably not in the same way. So that, according to the Dharma, our suffering is caused by our mind and by our kind of inner conditioning. But in addition to that, we can see that there's a lot of suffering that comes from, social forces and the way that society structures and power relationships in society. And yeah, different kinds of oppressive structures, I suppose. And if there's no contradiction here, or if this is kind of a part of the Dharma, why isn't it talked about more as a part of the teachings? That's a good question. So I guess you could say that the way that the teachings developed 2,500 years ago in India, they're kind of coming out of this meditative tradition, so that they're sort of, if you look at the early Buddhist tradition, is very much aimed at this kind of inner liberation. It's framed around an escape from samsara from conditioned existence, and there's a sort of a drive towards an inner liberation, and also framed very much as a kind of a stepping out of the world, or this is one kind of directionality within the teachings. But then at the same time, you can see that the Buddha was, in his teachings, he was quite socially involved, or he would discuss with kings and other rulers the kind of finer points of society. And also, you can see his teachings and the way that he structured the Sangha, the community of practitioners, as something quite revolutionary, that there's this sort of stepping away from the rejecting the caste system, which is this, at the time, the kind of very powerful, hierarchical social system, oppressive system that was keeping people tied to the positions, the class positions where they were born. So that the way that the Buddha sort of structured his Sangha, his monastic community, it was a way of, it made it possible for people to step out of those oppressive structures and into another kind of community, I suppose, that gave them a kind of freedom, or made it possible for them to be kind of socially liberated. I wonder if this is the best way of answering this question, the historical perspective. I guess if I think about contemporary Buddhism, it feels like there's a whole variety of approaches, or a whole variety of teachings. So, you know, some people will emphasize much more the kind of inner meditative liberation, and kind of steer away from the external social forces. And then, in addition to that, there's other parts of the Dharma or other approaches that are much more engaged, that value this idea of social liberation, of bringing together the Dharma and the more kind of social movements. I'm struggling a little bit with answering this question. It feels like it's for me it's a super, like a really important question, but I think it's sort of the microphone and not having had time to reflect that I'm not. Yes, exactly. All right, let me just sit for a while. I'm still going to say it. It's going to come. if you have an impulse.
No, yeah, I really have an impulse more than anything. I think, first of all, I just want to acknowledge, yes, there is a shortcoming. First of all, yes, there is actually, there, if one could say, in the teachings, there is a time how we encounter it in the West, that there is a shortcoming. And this is something which has been also pointed out by Sangha. You know, which actually said, you know, why is this not spoken about? So, and I think this is also really, really part of a living and dynamic tradition. It's like, actually, there are some things missing here. So this was more my impulse, yeah. And I think there are now actually quite some amazing things happening, you know. And I don't say this, it was never mentioned. I don't say this, but I would say from my own experience, yes, there was a shortcoming. How I came to the teaching, it was from the beginning very clear how it was presented to me by my first teacher. What you are doing here on the cushion, its worth will be shown when you bring it to the world. So this was like, you know, the most important thing is how do we actually bring our understanding to the world. So there wasn't this duality with here I'm sitting on my cushion and, you know, outside there is whatever is going on. Also when I started practicing, I started to practice in the Thai monastery in Bodh Gaya, and I don't know if anyone has been there, like Bodh Gaya is in Bihar, it's one of the poorest area of India, one of the most deprived, unjust states of the Union of India, you know, with some Ladu, I think is his name, like a really, really, really a lawless, lawless, lawless name, and really like somehow a hotbed of misuse of power and abuse of power and oppression of poor people.
The joke is the only literate person to ever come out of Bihar was the Buddha.
Yeah. So and the Thai monastery in Bodh Gaya was in at the edge of town back then. I think now it's in the middle of town. So we were practicing, you know, and it was not like high walls. We were practicing in the middle of this, yeah, of the injustice, of the poverty, of the sheer, I mean, just heartbreaking misery of what humans are able to do of each other. So for me, it was never something other, you know. It was never something other. And I think one maybe very obvious way to make the connection, what is happening, one could say, what was happening outside of the walls of the Thai monastery, these were the effects of the deluded mind. These were the effects of the mind who believed in separation, in having power over, in dehumanizing the other. These were the expressions of it, really in your face. So then the connection, what has this to do with out there, the question didn't even arise because it was so obvious. You know, to see actually this is actually when I really follow how I perceive myself, how I'm trained to see world, other, how, when I'm following to these consequences, you know, I think I said it before here on Reddit, this is what will come out of it. So what I'm doing here is to really look deeply and see see the pain and see the conditionality of it, see the pain of it, and also actually having a sense that there is a teaching and really something, again, without being able to grasp it, which point to something radically different, completely different way of looking at the world, of looking at self and others. And, you know, you might feel how passionate I still feel about this, you know. It just wasn't a question, you know. This has completely to do with power structures. And this is actually, you know, with injustice. It's about, you know, it's about, again, one part, there's many more layers. One part is actually, is how does this mind work? You know, what are the misconceptions which brings rise to this? You know, a little bit what you said, this brings forth that, you know, the sensation of this will bring forth the sensation of that. So, that's my impulsive.
Great, thank you.
Can I just add something? Because I'm just wondering about, like, because in a way you could say that, okay, if it's the grasping that's causing suffering, whoever is poor and is treated badly and whatever, you could just say that, teach them Dharma, and then they stop grasping.
It's not what I'm saying.
No, but I mean, that's kind of a different angle. Like, somehow I feel that teaching so that the conditions don't matter, actually. We wouldn't need to say that.
Yeah, I see what you mean. You know, I see what you mean. But I think it's very easy to say this from the privileged point of view. Yeah. You know, actually, if someone says this in terms of, you know, we are all privileged, and then we say, you know, it's all your making of your mind, I would say there is an immense lack of compassion, you know. Again, this is a very trite, there are more layers to it, but this is my first response, you know, because also what the teachings point to, you know, actually is the beauty, is actually the wanting of the human heart to respond to what is to suffering, actually. The immediate response, actually, before the head kicks in, is that you want to alleviate it. It's a very, very human response, you know. Whenever we see suffering, actually, the first thing is like, I want to do something, yeah. So, and I think part of for me, again, it's like once more, it's such a big question, but is to really honor this impulse, to really, this is something which makes this human existence such a precious, precious, precious gift, such a precious innate quality we are having. And the teaching, again and again, they point to this is what is worth investing, these qualities. And not from a puritanical point of view, you know, because they delight, you know, they delight. I think I stop here. Is it a little bit answering what you said? Yeah.